protect healthcare workers from coronavirus. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we hear from hospital workers on the front lines of the outbreak here in Florida. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, are you stuck at home? One show to stream right now is HBO's McMillions, telling a fascinating Jacksonville story. That's later. But first, we've got the latest for you right now on the spread of coronavirus in Florida. There are 328 positive cases here in the state. 23 of them came from our own five-county area. Now, this region's first death from COVID-19 was reported yesterday, a man in Clay County. Today, more businesses are closing to fight the spread of the disease, including the Avenues Mall and the St. John's Town Center. School systems across the state are out, and they are ramping up for a massive shift to home learning. Students won't go back to class until at least mid-April. But WJCT is staying open and continuing to broadcast for the duration. Our CEO, David McGowan, is here now with some thoughts. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. I just wanted to take a few minutes, Melissa, to inform our audience about how we are operating and some of the things that we're doing in order to enhance our services during this time. As many organizations are, we are doing as much of our work remotely as possible. Mm-hmm. We are really challenged, of course, to completely work remotely, given that we have a complicated set of broadcast operations. You and I are sitting here today in a radio studio, maintaining our social distance.
Yes.
Right. But we also have, of course, broadcasting towers that need to be maintained and certain things that have to be done on site. But as much as possible, we are working remotely. We have also moved to cancel or postpone, in most cases, events that were taking place here in the building. I think much of our audience knows that we do over 100 events a year, and so we have had to postpone those, and we've postponed all of those events through the month of April, and we will probably extend that through May. And the other thing that we have done in that regard is really limit our volunteer activities, because gathering volunteers here in our facility is probably not the right thing to do. And that has had an impact on one service that we provide and that we're proud of, which is the radio reading service, which is a volunteer-led service in which volunteers come in and read the local newspaper. That's a service that goes out to the sight impaired. And so we are still offering that service, but it is now a national service that we are not providing, you know, the local readers that we usually do. But in many ways, we are busier than ever, of course. You and your team here providing this program, but the entire news team, of course, is very active in reporting out this crisis. And one thing that we wanted to do was to create a central resource for information. You know, we were talking just before we came on the air, Melissa, about how much we're all scrambling for information, and we're all trying to find the online sources and that work the best. And you know, every morning we get up and look to find the latest, and we probably do the same throughout the day and before we go to bed. And so what we have done is create a resource that we think is very, very useful. It's available at wjct.org/coronavirus. And you don't have to remember the slash. That page is available right from our homepage under the More News section. And what we've done there is to gather in one spot all of the local reporting that we are doing, that our news partners are doing, but also, less importantly, all the statewide information, the national news from NPR that they are, of course, reporting very actively on this, in addition to a bunch of interactive resources from the Florida Department of Health. We've used the Johns Hopkins online widget. We put that in that place so that you can really go to that place and make sure that you are getting all the latest up-to-date information. Mm-hmm. And I know this is a long-winded streak of talking here, Melissa, but
that's
I wanted
right.
to mention one other aspect of that particular page, which is a Your Questions Answered section. We are inviting all of you to submit your questions to us that we can then go out and try to get the answers to. And you can do that. There is a Your Questions Answered section on that coronavirus website, and you can submit your questions to news@wjct.org. org. We, of course, can't answer all the questions that come in, but we will choose the ones that we think are most relevant to the biggest audience.
And to our digital editor, Bill Bortsfield, and news director, Jessica Palumbo, they've been working around the clock keeping this updated.
Absolutely. And everyone has really been, even as this newsroom is not the usual hive of activity in person, I can assure you that all of our reporters and all of our news professionals are as busy as they have ever been.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, we are not holding our pledge drive in light of recent events, but you can still always donate to we're a nonprofit organization that is going to be headed into this economic crisis right along with everyone else.
That's right. We have moved to postpone our pledge drive. I know there's probably a lot of broken hearts about that out there. I know how much everyone loves listening to that. But we've done that really because, as I mentioned, we've gone to a situation where we don't think it's right to bring a lot of volunteers into the building. And our pledge drives, usually right around this table that we're sitting at today, is where we invite a whole slew of volunteers to come in and help us answer the phones and so forth. And so we have moved to postpone that. But that doesn't mean that it's not a great time to give. I'm going to go on and spend a few more minutes, Melissa, describing some other activities that we're working on. And all of these are really only available because of your support. So let me take a minute to mention some of the work that we're also doing for kids and families during this time. We have, in addition to the regular children's programming, educational, non-commercial programming that we run every day on WJCTV and on our WJCT PBS Kids channel, we're working to use our broadcasting resources to expand the work we do with schools and teachers. And that includes some things that we've done right away. We've extended the deadline of our writers contest, which is a great activity for children who are stuck at home to participate in. We have also moved our Kids Club newsletter to weekly frequency. That newsletter provides all kinds of educational activities that parents can do with their children that teachers can also utilize. And maybe most importantly, we are actually working today in order to extend our broadcasting capabilities to provide educational programming for middle and high school age students as the Duval County School System, many school systems are working with home learning. And we are taking a page out of the book that was developed in California, where the Los Angeles County School District has moved to work with their local PBS station to provide a service that is useful to teachers teaching older age groups. And so we're working with other stations across the state of Florida to try to make that happen.
So if you have internet access, you can learn all about this at WJCT.org, especially the home learning for your children. If you don't, you could just give us a call at 353-7770, because one of the great things about PBS is that it's free to everyone who has a television. And you can access a lot of these services through your local public media outlet, which is WJCT. And as David said, you can still donate to us anytime you want at WJCT.org. But of course, that big link everyone's checking out right now is WJCT.org/coronavirus. Thank you so much, David, for being here.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, the people on the front lines of this crisis, without a doubt, are hospital workers. Across the country right now, they're raising concerns about the lack of equipment, testing kits, their safety, and that of their patients. Right now, we are speaking to one of them. His name is Michael Sampson. He's a representative with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He's on the line. Michael, good morning.
How are you doing today?
Thanks for being with us. And as we talk about the coronavirus outbreak, we want to hear from all of you, but especially if you work in the healthcare field, we want to hear from you. The number to join us is 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. And our Facebook page is open. Okay, so employees at UF Health, who are represented by AFSCME, are raising concerns about their safety and that of patients. We're hearing from UF Health that you're not treating any COVID-19 patients currently in Jacksonville. So tell me what your concerns are, Michael.
Well, the concerns that we've gotten from a lot of our members, UF Health, who represent around 2,400 employees who work there. That ranges from nurses, medical assistants, PCAs, to even all the way to the food service employees and the janitors who work at UFL. And a lot of the concerns we've gotten from the nurses has been the lack of PPE, equipment, masks. There's a shortage of masks that exist at the hospital that they haven't, gotten a supply restocking yet. There's concerns about, taking sick leave. If a nurse feels sick, currently the current attendance policy is still in place. So, there's OSHA recommendations that are, encouraging employers to encourage their employees, if you're feeling sick, to stay home. But oftentimes, a lot of our employees, they're kind of stuck in a situation in which if they stay home, they'll be penalized for the internal attendance policy of UF Health or other employers, but they still have to provide for their families. So they're kind of stuck in between that gray area of, do I go to work to make money for my family, even though I may be feeling something, or do I stay home and not have enough money for my family? So that's the one concern. And also the idea of even, the lack of information that a lot of the employees are getting in regards to, if patients have even contracted this virus. If you're working in a building, the main campus may house around 4,000 employees. That's a lot of people, walking around. And if employees aren't aware of if any patients have the virus, then it's hard to, practice, certain precautions. The main thing is, a lot of times, we think about first responders. We usually think about, firefighters and police officers. But in a situation like this, with this virus, the first responders in a lot of ways are these healthcare professionals who are the ones, dealing with patients. I've talked to young nurses this week who were telling me weeks ago they feel as though they were taking care of patients who had symptoms, high fever, et cetera, but those patients weren't getting, the tests done because there's a shortage of tests. So in a lot of ways, UF Health, like other hospitals, are kind of hamstrung by the gutting of a lot of federal and state funding that has been done over the past years to our healthcare and hospital industry. And we're kind of seeing the results of that now. We're seeing, like I said earlier, lack of equipment, a lack of resources to be able to cover employees who need to take leave. As of now, management at the hospital is requiring that if an employee gets quarantined or needs to self-isolate for 2 weeks.
Has anyone been quarantined at UF Health, Jax?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. Not so far.
And let me just jump in and say we're speaking with Michael Sampson, who represents employees at UF Health Jax through AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937. Now, Michael, we did reach out to UF Health's public relations office, and we did get a statement from your CEO, Leon Haley. Now, let me read some of this here. He says, the health and well-being of our patients, visitors, and staff at UF Health Jax is paramount at this unique time. Leaders from across the organization are meeting multiple times a day to assess each possible scenario, which includes supplies, visitation, clinical care, employee safety, and more. He believes they're taking proactive steps and says, part of the challenge is ensuring we have adequate personal protection equipment for those who need it most. That includes patients and the caregivers who treat them. We currently have those supplies, but like many other hospitals, are being extremely vigilant to make sure we have enough moving forward. And he says as well that they are not treating any COVID-19 patients, but are well prepared to handle any situation. Okay, so like all the other hospitals around the country, the equipment that healthcare workers need is, I don't know if I want to say it's being rationed, but they're being very careful about how they dole it out. What are your members, your doctors and nurses and other staff saying? What equipment do they want? Just more safety masks so that they feel more secure going into the hospital each day?
Of course, more safety masks. I mean, how it is now is in order for a nurse to get a mask, they have to basically sign it out at the front desk with their manager or director. So they can keep track of that employee having that mask. Even when it comes to some nurses, I was talking to one of our leaders yesterday, and, you know, nurses wear gowns. You know, when they're going in the rooms or doing certain procedures, you know, they're not even being allowed to take multiple gowns throughout the shift. They have to, you know, wear at that point of rationing of supplies, in which you can only get one or two gowns, and that's not necessarily the safest practices for the patients. So I think a lot of, like what you touched on earlier, the lack of masks, the lack of other safety equipment like gowns, and just in general how it feels as though, it feels as though the concerns aren't really being heard. I know a statement is one thing, and, you know, we're thankful for, you know, management doing what they can to alleviate the crisis, but we just think that our employees deserve more.
Okay, as you continue to talk to your management, I know you represent a whole range of workers, but the thing that has been reported all over the country is that there are physicians and nurses who themselves have been hospitalized as a result of the coronavirus. Since UF Health JAX is the area's safety net hospital, do you have additional concerns about the risk of your staff there? Because it's the hospital where people will go if they feel that they have nowhere else to go, especially if they're feeling sick.
Of course. I mean, you know, like you said, UF Health is a safety net hospital. It mainly serves the indigenous kind of clientele around the area. More often low-income people of color. So, you know, these are often the people who suffer the worst in regards to medical issues, also a lack of quality health care in general. So that is a concern that is raised by a lot of our employees and a lot of our nurses, our medical assistants, where we have the resources, the ability to be braced for all this potential new patients. I mean, already, in my opinion, the hospital suffered in a lot of ways from understaffing, from a lack of resources, lack of necessary beds to be able to serve the population as it is.
And that's something that we're hearing from hospitals overseas, that the big concern for hospitals in America is that there will not be enough hospital beds and there will not be enough ventilators to treat patients if they are overwhelmed all at the same time with a rush of patients. What are you hearing from your healthcare folks, your medical professionals about that?
100%. I mean, you know, oftentimes, you know, nurses have to take on more patients before the virus than they were prepared to do, even in ICU. So you compound that with the virus, in which you may have a huge patient influx of folks in the ICU. It's just going to be very difficult for our employees, our people, to really take care of that. Of course, they're fighters. You know, they're going to do what they can. But it just presents a difficulty. And it's very much unprecedented, uncharted territory. I don't think UF Health or any hospital, for that matter, has had to deal with this level of crisis.
And since we are in uncharted territory, can the hospital realistically get enough masks to cover all your staff and everyone you represent? Are they in the same boat as every other hospital right now? There just isn't enough to go around.
Well, in a lot of ways, we think that swift action by Washington and Tallahassee and other areas that can help out with funding is the best way to really handle a lot of these crises. But we do believe there are some things that management can do on the UF Health side to, you know, assuage a lot of the concerns from the employees and to have a more compassionate voice when it comes to these concerns being raised. You know, we understand that you know, they have an operation to run. They have patients to take care of. But our employees, our members, our nurses, you know, we're the ones who are on the front line taking care of those patients and involved in patient care.
And here's a comment on our Facebook page from John. I am a registered nurse doing home health care. The vast majority of patients I see are seniors, particularly vulnerable to the virus, and they've been discharged from hospitals treating the virus within the last 2 days. I am also over 60 years old myself. In my immediate family are three people with significant vulnerability. So as a family, we've decided that they and even the family dog will sit out the next few weeks in a cabin in the mountains of Western North Carolina. This makes me a little bit sick being left all alone at home and working in a stressful situation. But it has the benefit of relieving the stress of bringing the virus home to any of those who would have such a difficult time dealing with it. That shows you the choices healthcare workers are making, Michael, right now.
Of course. I mean, I talked with a nurse yesterday who was, you know, who has a husband, you know, like she has children. And, of course, her children are out of school now. So that kind of makes her schedule kind of crazy. And then her husband, you know, due to his job situation, he's in a bad predicament. So now she has to go to her manager and ask for some new hours different than her shift to take care of child care. So it's not just, you know, dealing with patients at home. It's also think about if you have children who are now out of school for weeks and you had a set schedule already in place, you have to figure out arrangements for them. You also have to make sure that when you go to work, you're not contracting the virus and bringing it home to your family. So a lot of that we feel as though can be solved if UF Health and, you know, is willing to pitch in regards to making sure that if employees need to stay home, they don't fear their pay leave being drained or they don't fear that they won't have enough money to make ends meet when they get their paycheck because they had to stay home to take care of their kids or they had to stay home to make sure they wasn't bringing any symptoms to work. And also one of the things that concerned us was if, you know, if any employee, let's say, contracted coronavirus at the hospital, it would have to be proven that they were in direct care of a patient who contracted it for them to get any benefits and get paid to be on workman's comp or be home with, you know, in self-quarantine.
Right. That's that's hard to prove. It's impossible to know. I mean, we're in a situation of community spread now, aren't we, Michael, where there are cases popping up that you there's no way to trace whether they came from China or Italy or they were just spread through the domestic community here. So it's really difficult to assess where people might have picked it up at this point.
Of course. And what we propose to UFL leadership was that, you know, this kind of attendance policy be done on a case-by-case basis because this is extraordinary times. You know, you don't want employees coming to work who may have symptoms. You want to make sure that they're comfortable enough to even tell their management and tell their leadership that they're exhibiting symptoms. But at this point, you know, I talked to a surgical tech in OR yesterday who was telling me how, you know, he's seen one or two people coughing at work, you know, but they're at work, you know, and they have to come because of fear of if they miss a day at work, they may, incur a penalty on the attendance policy or they may be subject to a corrective action if they have missed days in the past.
Millions of American workers don't have the backing of a union like yours to argue their case. They are in these situations and jobs all over the country without anyone to advocate for them. So that is another sad part of this crisis. Again, we want to reiterate, we did receive a statement from the leadership at UF Health responding to your concerns. And by the way, we just got another email from UF Health saying that the policy involves three different scenarios on taking leave. Here it is. If you are told to go home after treating a positive COVID patient, you will be required to go home and self-quarantine for 14 days, but you will be paid during that time normal pay. There are two other scenarios that we feel are fair, and as of this time, we have no positive COVID-19 patients. That's the latest from the spokesperson. But Michael, representing AFSCME employees at UF Health JAX, I want to thank you for appearing with us and giving us a window into how healthcare workers are dealing with this crisis right now. We really appreciate you being on the show.
Of course. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
That's Michael Sampson, a representative with AFSCME, the largest trade union of public employees in the United States. Up next, help for local residents struggling to pay their bills through this crisis. We'll tell you about the First Coast Relief Fund next. Florida responds to coronavirus. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
This Friday, all K through 12 schools in Florida are closed through April 15th in order to flatten the curve of the spread of COVID-19. Also, how will social distancing affect the state's restaurant industry?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Friday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best down-tempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, nonprofit organizations are struggling right now, and they need help to survive. The First Coast Relief Fund is meeting the challenge. It's being reactivated to help them and this entire area get through the coronavirus outbreak, because with so many closures, the economy is expected to slow way down. Michelle Braun is president and CEO of United Way of Northeast Florida, and she's on the line. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. And we want to hear from you out there right now. Do you work at a local nonprofit, a local business that's struggling? Are you an individual struggling with bills? Are you worried about how you're going to pay bills as we get through these next weeks and months? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Okay, Michelle, what is the First Coast Relief Fund?
The Relief Fund was launched in 2016, Melissa, by some of the area's largest funding partners to coordinate a response to our first hurricane that we had in a while, Matthew, which was notably more impact down south in our St. John's County. The Relief Fund covers all six area counties, Baker, Clay, Duval, Nassau, Putnam, and St. John's. And the funders came together, the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida, United Way here in Northeast, in Jacksonville, as well as in St. John's County, and the Jewish Federation. And this is based on best practices that we've learned from around the country of how to coordinate during a response so that people, donors, and nonprofits aren't confused about how to get access to funding. And we've learned it's worked really well to maximize relief efforts in Hurricane Irma. We raised $4 million and helped a quarter of a million people in the six-county area.
Wow.
So we came together and said we need to do this again because we're in a different kind of storm.
Sure. So it's really all the biggest philanthropic players in the community working together, which is great.
It's fantastic. Our corporate partners are also stepping up. It's an easy way for them to be able to donate to one place. Florida Blue, Wells Fargo have already made commitments. They're confirming the exact amounts. And we just encourage others to consider whether, you are thinking about how to respond, to please consider this fund, because we will work together with our nonprofit partners. We're working with the city to coordinate a response that meets the most immediate needs first and then plans for longer term impacts.
What are the most critical needs, Michelle?
We're still assessing. We're having calls, as you can imagine, daily. First of all, I wanted to say the nonprofits in our community and in many communities are incredible, as you know. Some people might not realize that nonprofits represent the third largest workforce across the United States, and we're working in Washington, D.C. to make sure there's relief for nonprofits as well in the relief packages. But locally, nonprofits are having to adapt this always happens when there's critical needs. The needs go up while the revenue goes down. Many nonprofits have had to cancel fundraisers. They're having to work in this new environment of protective and social distancing and still deliver critical services. So the number one need that we're hearing right now is as layoffs are happening and people are disrupted is the need for food. The problem, one of the problems is in our area, before we had anything to do with COVID-19, 40% of people were one paycheck away essentially from not being able to meet their bills. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine how quickly that's exasperating. So food is the number one need right now, and that is a problem since that's, you know, everyone is trying to access food. So we're working with Feeding Northeast Florida, Farm Share, and some of our partners, the local pantries, to make sure that that need is met. Nonprofits are doing a great job of providing food like the school system is in unique ways and grab-and-grow ways to make sure that they're, you know, being safe. And trying to use current staff, one of our things is we're trying not to lay off nonprofit staff.
Okay, so food and other supplies, and then also will the fund help with childcare support for all the families that have kids at home right now?
So we're trying to make sure we understand the issue. Because there are people at home, there's some people who don't have childcare issues. Our first responders and those that you were just talking about with the hospitals on the front line are our first priority we're seeing, and making sure that the Early Learning Coalition, one of our partners, is also, we're understanding the need so that they can keep childcare centers open in responsible and safe ways. But the YMCA and some others, the Kids Hope Alliance, the school district, are working together to find creative solutions for childcare for first responders. And that will be our first, I think, Melissa, our first focus. And then, you know, things are evolving quickly, and so we want to have enough money in this fund that we can address those other issues.
And how much money do you hope to gather together for the First Coast Relief Fund?
Well, I'm hoping that we can exceed what we did in Irma, which is the $4 million mark. Our friends in Chicago have already raised $8 million in the same amount of time. So obviously that's Chicago, but the need is just so great, and we are encouraging anyone individual donors can give here. The agencies that will be supported are not only United Way-funded agencies or those funded by the grant makers. It's anyone who's eligible that's doing the work, you know, that's a nonprofit. This money is for nonprofits. Nonprofits will then serve individuals. The application and it will for nonprofits will be available on the website at the same place where you can donate. Nonprofits can also apply. The application is not up yet. It should be up by Friday or no later than Monday.
And you simply go to the United Way, NEFL.org website, UnitedWayNortheastFlorida.org, to apply for these funds. Let's take a few calls right now from Michelle Braun, CEO of United Way of Northeast Florida. Michelle and other philanthropic leaders in the community are working together to reactivate the First Coast Relief Fund, last used during Hurricane Irma, to help people through local nonprofits who are really being harmed by economic, serious outcomes in the wake of the spread of coronavirus. 549-2937. Tony is in Jacksonville. Hi, Tony. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Tony in Duval. My concern was for gig economy and independent contractors. I'm so sorry. I was eating an orange because they said that was good for me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead. So you're worried about people that have gig work. Sure.
Gig economy workers and independent contractors. Their work has dried up and it's going away. So we need a stimulus package, not only from the federal government, but hopefully from our wonderful mayor, Lenny Curry, so that he can get something for the people. Some of us, our work is gone. There's no more restaurants at a certain amount of time. People are staying in the houses. So that means we can't even begin to get a semblance of employment, but we still have the car notes to pay, insurance, but not only those, we can let those go. We still have to pay the rent and the home. A lot of them don't have any type of health insurance, and my deductible is $2,500. But I don't want to keep you long. I just wanted to say those things, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, and what do you do? How do you make money, Tony? Are you still working?
I'm the gig economy. Yes, ma'am. I don't want to start crying, so I'm going to hang up the phone. But I just wanted to say that for everybody, because there's people out here are not going to get anything, and they're sitting up at the airports or they're waiting for rats or calls. So I just wanted to say that because we're here.
I know.
We have been helping our community for a long time. And so now we would ask our community to help us.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much,
Tony.
I don't want to cry.
It's okay. It's okay. I know how you feel right now, and I know why you're worried. We're all worried.
Thank you.
So, Tony,
Tony, bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Thank you. Now, Michelle, for people like Tony that are scared to death and worried about how they're going to pay their bills, how can they access this relief money? They can't individually apply for it. So how can they find out what they qualify for in the way of relief?
So thank you, Tony. We're thinking of you, and that's why we need to launch this fund. I do want to say that there is, of course, government relief that's being planned right now and was voted on last night. And so we're working closely to understand how that money will flow. And we don't want this money of the relief fund will not replace or replicate any of those funds. Of course, we want to use government funds first. And so we understand, at least right now, that the first checks that the for laid off or workers have been impacted wouldn't be available until April. And so that's part of the problem.
The government checks,
if that's what happens. So I just want the listeners to know that we're coordinating with that. And so what we will do is we're putting in place the financial hardship plan where people can go to our great nonprofits who already do case management work and can make sure they understand the situation. And if someone is eligible, it sounds like we just heard that we can provide money to help them pay the rent or keep the lights on, et cetera.
Should they just call the 3-digit number to reach the United Way? Is that the best way to start?
So 211 is a hotline for helping people. Right now, none of those plans aren't precisely in place, so I'm worried that if people called, we wouldn't be able to say, here's where you go right now. But we will continue to advertise and make sure people know exactly how to access the help as soon as we can coordinate with the federal government and our local providers to make a plan.
So why do you have to wait until the government checks go out to help people through this fund that you're putting together?
We're not waiting. That's why we need a fund, but we need to, A, have money in the fund, and so we need to raise the money so that we can make sure we can address the needs. And, B, we want to understand what the rules are for those funds so that we don't accidentally, disqualify the individuals from receiving those funds later. So since this was just passed last night, we're just trying to absorb the exact information, and then we will communicate of the type of money and where to go to access it. Certainly food is one of the first things on our mind.
Let's go to Ray in Clay County. Hi, Ray. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. I just wanted to say I'm a volunteer. I go out twice a week and volunteer at the VA hospital in Jacksonville. And I drive people from Jacksonville over to Gainesville and over to Lake City so they can make their appointments, because these are a lot of vets that don't have insurance and, they struggle to make it every week. And, they need to see the doctors. They got medical problems. Some of them have, they have to go there for chemotherapy and stuff. And now the VA has put everything on hold. They said, we're not driving and we're not going to be able to get nobody to their appointment. So I worry about these vets that are left on the street that are, without a way to get to their doctors and get help that they need.
Yeah. Ray, and thanks for helping them out. Thank you for calling too. There's so many vulnerable populations, Michelle, veterans, the homeless, seniors, that United Way is thinking about right now.
That's right. And one of the things that Ray points out is we have a lot of our amazing volunteers are themselves seniors and being directed to stay indoors. And so that is putting extra pressure on nonprofits. And in some cases, nonprofits, we heard earlier, don't have the enough protective equipment when they're in situations where they need to, like at the homeless shelters. So they've asked volunteers not to come. And so there's a lot of disruption in the system, and a normally, strong delivery system is having to rework how they work. So there might be some areas where we're going to ask for volunteers, and there's some areas where, unfortunately, we're thanking our volunteers but saying we can't use it right now in a safe way.
Carell is in St. Augustine. Hi, Carell. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are your thoughts?
So I'm in St. Augustine, and we have a very strong service industry here. And while I 100% agree with keeping our community safe, the rent is very high for some people. Thankfully, our bills are quite low, but I'm just concerned about my colleagues, and I was wondering if the city will be providing any aid or at least freezing any ability for electricity and rent or water to be turned off, because we're very dependent on our service industry. So I'm just curious if the city will be helping at all for the workers who are now out.
Right. You know, thank you for that. You know, some cities have started to do that, Michelle, just suspending rent payments. You know, does that need to be done?
Well, some of our local businesses, JEA, for instance, and some of the light and energy leaders have made some decisions to no longer cut off, you know, if people haven't paid, they're not turning off services. And, you know, again, this is rapid, as you know, quickly moving. And there are really great things being put in place. But there's also some, we're trying to coordinate with the national things that are going on. And yesterday, President Trump talked about reducing or eliminating evictions and that type of thing, putting a halt to those for the temporary time being. We're trying to catch up with exactly what has been said and what is actually happening. But we understand that people are under pressure. And the last thing we need to do is to have people not have a place to be right now. So we're working hard on that. I don't have solid, here's exactly what the rules are. But the cities that we are working with are definitely looking into that, as well as the, you know, main utility and other providers.
Okay. Now, with all of that said, as you mentioned a minute ago, you need to raise $4 million in short order for the First Coast Relief Fund. So you want to get the message out to everyone who has the means to help you with that. How can people help get this fund really robust? How can they donate?
We're asking people to donate, to share the links and the information, and of course, nonprofits are eligible to apply. So as you mentioned, you can go to any of the partner websites. There is also its own website at United Way, N-E, like Northeast FL, Florida, unitedwaynefl.org/COVID-19 response. But you can go to unitedway.org, and it will get you there as well. You can also text to give, so you can type in the number in your phone, 40403, and then type into the where you put your message, COVID-19 relief, and you'll get immediately a text back telling you how you can apply online. And of course, you can always, we are still taking mail, thankfully, and we appreciate the letter carriers for doing that. So you can email to United Way of Northeast Florida. Our address is on the website. Please share this information. There's social media posts out there. We'll continue to post, forward it. This is the time for all of us to come together, and we will do our part with the nonprofits to support them so they can support you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. She's Michelle Braun, CEO of the United Way of Northeast Florida. Again, that website is unitedway.nefl.org as the United Way and others come together to reactivate the First Coast Relief Fund. Donate, and you can apply for funding if you're a nonprofit very soon. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thanks for all you're doing, Melissa. We appreciate your calm voice in the storm.
Thank you. Well, are you stuck at home during all of this? Up next, we have an idea for what you can watch as we hear from one of the local FBI agents who helped crack the case behind the McMillions scam. That's next.
As the coronavirus spreads, some people are stepping up. In Texas, one woman is taken to the streets to help people stuck at home.
I basically play on foot courier, and I run from house to house, picking up items from one house and dropping them off at another.
Neighbors helping neighbors this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Robin Young. Nick Pelham spent 6 weeks trapped in Iran after being detained on a reporting trip. He got out before the spread of COVID-19, but says the regime's lack of transparency fueled transmissions.
It has a record of saying one thing and doing the other, and there is just an enormous extent of mistrust by the population at large.
Next time, Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Marco Werman. At The World, we're always looking beyond our borders to get the global take on the news. That's especially important as we deal with a pandemic. We take you to places where the coronavirus struck first, places that may recover from its effects before the U.S. Join us as we take on each day's news from a global perspective. That's why we call it The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Big cities are asking whether to ask millions to shelter in place, but there's another part of the country where coronavirus has been described as rampant, the Colorado Mountains. They're home to some of America's best-known ski resorts, and now their seasonal economies are struggling with high rates of infection. I'm Todd Zwillick. We'll find out why. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the HBO documentary series McMillions takes a look at the big con that allowed one man to rig the results of McDonald's popular Monopoly game for an entire decade. Let's listen.
This story has got everything. Revenge.
Drugs.
Greed.
Ronald McDonald.
Somebody went to the FBI and said, guess what's happening?
The McDonald's Monopoly game was fixed. The Bureau thought it was just some BS story.
McDonald's Monopoly game gave millions of people a chance to win.
But from 1989 to 2001, there were almost no legitimate million-dollar winners.
The FBI told us the game pieces are being stolen.
McDonald's was shocked.
How about that? Now, the scam happened right here in Jacksonville. FBI agents from our local Jack's field office cracked the case. If you're stuck at home right now due to the coronavirus and looking for a great show to watch, this is one to check out. Chris Graham, a former supervisory special agent who supervised the McMillions case and has since retired from the FBI, is on the phone. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. You know, we'd known about this story for a little while, and it's exciting to see it get the HBO treatment. What's been your reaction to this series?
It's amazing. I mean, I'm very surprised at the level of interest and the positive comments that have come from all over. I'm glad we finally got a chance to illuminate some of the inside work that the FBI does on a case like this. For me personally, I mean, it's been a great reason to go back in time and reconnect with some old friends and colleagues, and give them an excuse to reach out and reconnect and tell old stories and recount the case as it was.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, people may remember this. When you would go to McDonald's when this Monopoly thing was running, they'd find game pieces on the French fry box or the drink cups or whatever. And they could get free food most often, but if they got a really valuable game piece, they would even get a free car or up to $1 million in cash. A former police officer found a way to steal these pieces and sell them at a profit and then distribute the winning tickets to family and friends. And then a whole network of people was selling the pieces all over the country. How did the local FBI agents crack this case?
Yeah, well, like any case, we often rely on the public to come forward and, in the form of confidential sources or informants. And, we were fortunate in this case to have, somebody come forward and give us enough information to start running with the case. As I've said before, I think, initially we got that information and we thought, wow, this is, if this is true, this is significant, but it did seem a little far-fetched. And, as we know now, it was not far-fetched. And, went way beyond the initial information and way beyond Jacksonville and way beyond the first few people. So,
But how did you find this guy? He was in charge of securing these pieces, right? He was a security firm employee, and he started putting his hand in the till.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the early decisions we had to make was, do we contact McDonald's? And we quickly realized that we had to reach out to them, understanding that there's a possibility that, you know, somewhere within McDonald's this is happening. From those early meetings with McDonald's and some of our investigation, you know, we learned that there was a company named Simon Marketing who was in charge of doing the pieces, and then, you know, and then from there identified who could possibly be involved in this. You know, and you know, the TV show I think did a really good job of you know, examining parts of it. You know, early on it became a matter I don't want to oversimplify it, but, you know, it became a matter of getting a list of winners from McDonald's, and then looking at their phone records and then seeing, okay, who are they calling? And then ultimately, are those calls from people in the middle going to anybody else? And, you know, as we know now, they were going to this person, Jerry Jacobson, who, just so happened to fit into the role of the head of security at Simon Marketing, and would have been the person who had
access to the
game piece.
We're almost out of time, but the whole series has shown a light on the incredible work you and your colleagues at the FBI did. That's got to feel good.
Yeah. I mean, normally white collar crime cases are forensic in nature. In other words, you know, the crime happened, and we're figuring out what happened in the past through records. And, you know, rarely do you get a chance to investigate a case like this as the crime is happening. So, you know, that was great.
It is great. And we're up against a break, but I just want to encourage people to check it out. It's almost done with its run. So check it out now. It's McMillions on HBO. And he is Chris Graham, a former supervisory special agent who supervised the case here in the Jacksonville FBI field office. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for watching.
All right. And that's our show. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Everybody stay cool out there. We will all get through this together.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.